Hi, this is Doug Henwood. This interview with Tarek Ali was recorded on September 15, 2008. Tarek is the author of a couple of dozen books, most recently of The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, published by Scribner's. Aside from political and historical analysis, he's also written several novels and spent some time as a filmmaker, too. Born in Lahore, Pakistan, in 1943, he moved to Britain in his early 20s, where he got deeply involved in the radical politics of the 1960s. He's the alleged inspiration for the Rolling Stones song Street Fighting Man, although as far as I know, Tarek has never sung for a rock and roll band. Tarek Ali.
Welcome, Tarek. What is your history in Pakistan? Were you born there, grew up there?
I was born in Lahore when it was still part of India. When I was 3 and a half, it became part of a new country, Pakistan. So I grew up in that country, and those were my formative years. I left when I was nearly 20 and came to study at Oxford. But the first 20 years in one's life remain with one forever, and they were very formative years. And there is a story which my mother tells, that the woman who looked after me, the family retainer, took me on a demonstration when Pakistan was being formed. And I actually held the Pakistan flag and shouted, "Long live Pakistan," with everyone else. I have no recollection of this, but if this is so, it's the only time in my life I've ever done that.
No pictures, though.
No pictures to expose me.
And your family was pretty well connected politically?
Yeah, my extended family was an old feudal family. My father, who became a communist, used to describe as a decaying feudal aristocracy, and the sooner the better. And my grandfather, my mother's father, was Prime Minister of the Punjab throughout the 30s, and my father's father, my paternal grandfather, was a member of his cabinet. So this was a part of the ruling elite of that time, owned large tracts of land. But my parents both became communists at a young age, so I was brought up in an incredibly bohemian household. You know, we had the family on the one hand, and we had poets, playwrights, trade union leaders, peasant leaders, Communist Party leaders who were going underground, passing through our house virtually nonstop. That's the country I remember, and the Pakistan I grew up in. And, you know, there were reactionary layers were leading the country, but there was still space to be critical and still space to dissent. And a group of left-wing intellectuals, including my father, decided that a new country needed a newspaper chain. This is a country being created from nothing. And they got together with a whole group of people, including wealthy leftist sympathizers, and set up a chain called the Progressive Papers Limited, which produced the country's largest circulation newspapers from 1947 to 1959. When the military coup took place in October 58, the U.S. ambassador is reported to have said to them, "We need these papers taken over." So they took over the nationalized, the Progressive Papers Limited, and they became government papers. But a whole generation was brought up on these newspapers, and they weren't communist newspapers, but they were radical left, progressive, anti-imperialist newspapers, which educated an entire generation. People still talk about it. So it wasn't a surprise that they were taken over at some point, because the U.S. never liked them. I mean, it's quite funny. I was looking through my father's archives when I last visited Pakistan, and I found a letter from the U.S. Consul General in Lahore, saying, "Dear Mazhar, I've just read your editorial denouncing us once again, but this time in language which is unacceptable. So with great regrets, I have to disinvite you and your wife from dinner tonight."
And cancel my subscription. Moving from the personal history to the national, how did Pakistan emerge out of the British Empire at the same time India did?
Well, look, in my opinion, and I argue this in the book, essentially what happened was that the Second World War became a very critical period for the British Empire. The Congress Party, led by Gandhi and Nehru, picked that moment, not foolishly from their point of view, to demand that the British quit India. Nehru, a great Indian nationalist leader, said, you decide to leave India now, and a free India will decide, of its own accord, whether or not to back you in the war. We probably will, but we don't want to be pushed into the war on your say-so. Gandhi, who was a shrewd old fox, actually thought that the Japanese were going to win. So he began a mega campaign called the Quit India Movement in August 1942, soon after the fall of Singapore. And when he did this, the British just panicked and locked them up, because if they lost India at that time, they didn't know what was going to happen. The Muslim League, a party of Muslim grandees and a sprinkling of bourgeois and petty bourgeois lawyers and traders and professionals, which had been set up on the say-so of the British to find the Indian Muslims a voice, supposedly, then became extremely important, because the two big parties that backed the British during the Second World War, one was the Muslim League and the other was the Communist Party of India after the Soviet Union was attacked, became total supporters of the war, which they hadn't been before. I've always felt that Pakistan was a thank you present to the Muslim League from the British Empire, saying, you've been very good with us, here you can have your country. If the Congress had backed the British during the Second World War, it's an open question whether Pakistan would have come into being. But it came into being, and it came into being as a state whose leadership was largely secular. And I often compare it to Israel, which was another state which used religion to come into existence, but the leadership of the Israeli state, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, were totally secular, in fact atheists. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, was an agnostic, to put it at its mildest. He was not a religious person at all. He was a very brilliant criminal lawyer, very effective, and he became the central figure in the fight for Pakistan. But even he was surprised when he finally got his state. They were simply not prepared for this state to come into being.
And let's move through the post-war history. As the British left, Pakistan got a new imperial master, the United States. It was pretty quick that the U.S. moved in, wasn't it?
The transition was very rapid from the British to the United States. But you have to understand that the Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, died a year after the state was formed in 1948. The people who replaced him were people who had collaborated with the British Empire for their entire lives. They were used to taking orders. They were formed by the British. So when the British left, they were at a loss. Who was going to tell them what to do?
You have some very vivid descriptions of how enamored they were of their masters, right?
Completely. The best time in their lives was when they were fighting with the British, or when the British said to a Pakistani officer, gave him a nickname. They treasured this nickname for the rest of their lives and recalled it later. And when the United States became the major imperial power after the Second World War, they naturally felt, these people running Pakistan, that we need a new master. And I mean, I recount in this book the hilarious efforts they made to try and get the United States to take the country over, even before the United States had decided that they wanted to do so. So they sent the crudest possible letters to the State Department saying, we are anti-communist genetically because we are Muslims. We are going to be your staunchest ally in the fight against Muslims, in the fight against communism. Nehru and the Hindus next door are secular. They are playing, they want to be neutral. They don't want to take sides in the Cold War. We are totally prepared to be with you. Why don't you just buy our army? We require so much money to keep the army going. This is how much it'll cost. And why can't you just take it over? There's another episode which will embarrass many Pakistanis who rather idealized the founder of the state, Jinnah. The Jinnah asked the first U.S. ambassador for a tea on his launch off the shores of Karachi, the Governor General's launch. boat, and the American ambassador prepared himself and went thinking he'd be discussing high strategy or something. And Jinnah and his sister said to him, you know, we've got a big house in Karachi, and why doesn't the U.S. Rent this house for its embassy? This is the first serious conversation between the Pakistani head of states and the U.S. ambassador. And the guy, the U.S. ambassador, was quite embarrassed and said, well, actually, sir, we have an architect who's found us a house on such and such a road. And Jinnah persisted. He said, but surely you'll need accommodation for some of your people who'll be coming. And the ambassador then promised to have a look. And they then said, it's too grand for our employees who'll be living in small apartments. But the surveyor who went on behalf of the U.S. Embassy noticed that there were no ceiling fans in Jinnah's house. So when they reported this to the State Department, Marshall said, send them a present of 12 ceiling fans.
It's really low-level real estate dealing. I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, author most recently of The Duel, just out from Scribner. What were relations between Pakistan and India like at the beginning?
Relations were not good. Because the Indians, once Pakistan had been created, behaved badly, tried to not give Pakistan its share of the assets, and then there was a big dispute over Kashmir, which goes on to this day. The way Pakistan was formed was that all the Muslim majority areas of India would be offered a choice. Did they want to stay with India or did they want to go with Pakistan? Most, after some soul searching, chose Pakistan. Kashmir, where 80% of the population was Muslim, should have been offered this choice. But because it was a princely state, the Maharaja could decide who to accede to, and the Maharaja was not a Muslim. So under pressure, he acceded to India, and the movement erupted, and the Kashmiri nationalist leader, Sheikh Abdullah, got a pledge from Nehru that the Kashmiri people would be allowed a referendum to determine their own future. This was backed up by the United Nations. But this all happened after Pakistan attempted a short, sharp war to try and take Kashmir by force, and the Indians sent their troops in and took the airport first. So in 1948, you had the first war between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. And interestingly enough, because they couldn't fight this war openly, both countries' armies were led by British generals, who were naturally reluctant to order fight a war against each other. So irregulars were sent to Kashmir. Where were the irregulars coming from? The tribes in Waziristan, who are currently occupying the attention of the United States. These were the people who were sent into Kashmir. And they've got busy looting and raping nuns en route and couldn't take Srinagar in time. Had there been regular troops, I think Kashmir would have fallen. So this issue of Kashmir has been an issue which has divided these two countries right from the beginning.
Back to the U.S., I imagine it didn't take very long to win the favor of the United States in the war against communism. So that delivered Pakistan at the hands of a series of generals and other nasty rulers, right?
This is true. Essentially what happened was that once the Indians began to organize a non-aligned movement very seriously, with Nasser in Egypt, Tito in Yugoslavia, and the United States was panicking more and more at the rise of the revolution after the Chinese in 49, the Vietnamese, the wars in the Southeast. They were very worried about Asia, so they began to construct a series of security alliances. And Pakistan in 1951 to 53 was integrated into all these security alliances. These were not popular. And so in order to prevent the election of a government which might take Pakistan out of these security alliances, they organized one coup d'etat after the other. The Washington Quartet, as I describe in the book, is four generals who basically ruled that country for over half its existence. And these generals have wreaked havoc in the country. One lost the country when Pakistan broke up in 72. And East Pakistan became Bangladesh because they wouldn't accept the results of a democratic election. The second executed Benazir Bhutto's father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, after toppling him in a coup d'etat. given the green light by the United States because Bhutto had refused to listen to Henry Kissinger and continued to build the bomb. And Kissinger warned Bhutto in front of several civil servants in Pakistan, if you don't desist, i.e. on the question of nuclear weapons, Bhutto said, what will you do? Kissinger said, we'll make a horrible example out of you. And the example was the coup d'etat of General Zia in March 1977 and the fake trial and subsequent hanging of Bhutto in April 79. So the country has been essentially run by the army on behalf of the United States, which is why the subtitle of my book, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, is a very carefully considered subtitle, because it sums up what's been happening to this country from the 50s onwards. I mean, the U.S. lost interest soon with the end of the Cold War, after having wrecked Northwest Pakistan and Afghanistan and produced this layer of jihadis who finally hit Twin Towers and the Pentagon on 9/11. I mean, that was an outcome of what the U.S. had been up to. And they admit it now. There's no big secret about that. But they're back again, wrecking the country now, even as we speak, by this decision to enter Pakistan.
Of course, the latest of the generals was Musharraf, who is now off the scene. Tell us about him.
Well, Musharraf was the last of the dictators and the least repressive, except for his last years when power was draining away from him and he pushed through a state of emergency, sacked the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and seven other judges because they were considering his own legality.
That's interesting. The fight against him was led by lawyers and judges. What was that all about?
Well, the judges, Doug, were not the bravest of people in Pakistan, but something happened, purely accidentally, that a judge from a rather humble background, he was the son of an ordinary policeman, which rarely happens in that country, became Chief Justice of Pakistan, of the Supreme Court. And he began to take the law seriously. So if an ordinary person with no wealth went up before the court and their plea was sound, he declared in their favor. He said that the privatization of the steel industry was illegal and corrupt. The most dramatic episode was when a woman went to him and said her son had been disappeared and arrested by the security services on charges of being a terrorist. She had no idea what he was, whether he was guilty. And the Chief Justice became so angry that the Supreme Court instructed the head of the Federal Intelligence Agency, the equivalent of the FBI, to appear before him in the court. And he said, where is prisoner? And he named the guy. And the head of the Intelligence Agency said, we have no idea where he is. And the judge said, don't play games with me. Either you produce him within 48 hours or you will go to prison. Within 24 hours, the prisoner was produced before the Supreme Court. The judge said, what is the evidence? There was no evidence. The Americans and the British intelligence had said they wanted him locked up. So the judge ordered his release. The country was staggered. This has never happened anywhere before. So the Supreme Court became heroes, and the Chief Justice became a hero, and the United States Embassy said that the Chief Justice, or briefed journalists, the Chief Justice was a Taliban sympathizer, which was nonsense, and ran a campaign against him. And when Musharraf declared the state of emergency to dismiss these judges, the Western press more or less was either mute or half understood Musharraf's reasons. There was very little hard criticism. You just compare that to if a country the U.S. is opposed to, like Venezuela, had sacked the Supreme Court, the entire media networks would have been going at it. But in the case of Pakistan, very little response.
Well, of course, in Pakistan's case, Musharraf was the sole barrier between a bunch of bearded lunatics and the nuclear button, right?
Yeah, this is also, of course, a great deal of nonsense, because the notion that a group of nutty jihadis could seize Pakistan's nuclear facility could only exist in the mind of a fevered Hollywood scriptwriter. That's the sort of horror movie you make, you know, to scare people and frighten people. The Pakistan Army is an army which is 500,000 strong. The nuclear facilities in Pakistan are guarded just like they are here. There are 4 or 5 people who have access to them. So when I'm asked about that, I said the only way jihadis could take over the nuclear facility is if the military wanted them to. And the only way the military might threaten that is if the United States invades Pakistan. I said this 2 years ago. And we now seem to be approaching that scenario.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, author of The Duel, On the Flight Path of American Power, a book about Pakistan, just out from Scribner's. That 500,000-strong army and the intelligence services do have a rather complicated relationship with their bearded lunatics in the mountains, though, don't they?
Well, they do, and they don't particularly even try and hide it, because often when the U.S. wants to talk to the Taliban, look, the one thing we have to clarify, there is the Al-Qaeda group who really are nutty. Then there is the Taliban, which is increasingly in Afghanistan operating now as an umbrella organization, which is why even the British are beginning to refer to it as the Neo-Taliban, because it's a different organization. Lots of people now are part of it, and it will be a crucial body with which they have to negotiate. They have begun negotiations, and the British and the Americans asked the Neo-Taliban to join the Karzai coalition government. From being the world's worst group ever in the entire history of humanity, they were approached to join the coalition government. And they, from their point of view, in quite a principled way, said, well, we're not opposed to being part of a coalition, but not while any foreign troops are in the country. So you go, and then we'll talk. Which is what they did even, you know, before the Taliban were in negotiations with the U.S. for a long time. There was a semi-Taliban consulate in Manhattan during the period they were in power. But this is a new group now, with the old and a lot of new people. And there's no doubt the Pakistanis are in touch with them. The ISI is in touch with them. The U.S. is also in touch with them via the Pakistani intelligence groups. If you go to the Serena Hotel in Swat in Pakistan, it's full of American names, U.S. intelligence experts who speak Pashtun, who go there and often engage in talks and negotiations, which is quite a relief, actually. It shows that there is another side of this, which is rarely reported, which is going on, which means that there are some people in the U.S. at least thinking of an exit strategy. But there's no doubt that the Pakistani intelligence services are not going to give up on Afghanistan, because they know the West can't stay there forever. So the question for them will be, once the West goes, do we move in again as we did when they left the last time? And this is a big problem, and I've been arguing, and I argue in the book, that in terms of Afghanistan, an exit strategy has to involve a regional solution. The temptation for the U.S. will be to tell the Pakistanis, as they did in the past, okay, guys, you handle this for us. That would be really bad for Afghanistan if just one power and one group in Afghanistan controlled it again. So I think what you require in Afghanistan is essentially Pakistan, India, Iran, and Russia. Now, the U.S., of course, the thought of involving Iran or now Russia in negotiations, they'd sort of go berserk. But that is what has to be done, because these are two powers very strong in that region. I think Pakistan, India, Iran, and Russia could guarantee 10 years of peace, a national government in Afghanistan, and a slow process of social reconstruction in the country. If they were allowed to do so, they would do it. The Pakistanis won't agree on their own and have to be pressed to do so, which makes the United States extremely important again.
Zardari, the new boss, is he same as the old boss?
Zardari is a godfather figure. Essentially, when he was married to Benazir Bhutto, when she was alive, of course, and she was prime minister, this guy went on a sort of spree. The most corrupt person in the country got a cut on every deal, made a fortune, is now listed as the second richest man in Pakistan. His properties litter several continents. His large country house in Britain, a great deal of property in Manhattan, had a lot of money in the investment banks. I did wonder whether Lehman Brothers was one of his watering holes, but maybe not. In any case, he became extremely rich and was wanted for corruption in Britain and in Switzerland, in a Geneva court, for laundering corrupt money and demanding bribes from Swiss companies and stuff. So he really was one of the most hated people in the country, because this is a poor country. You know, the price of flour and wheat has now risen to such levels that even ordinary middle-class families can't afford to have flour and chapatis three times a day. This is the situation in the country. The social situation is appalling. And at this time, the so-called People's Party, which is essentially the Bhutto family party, having lost their leader, accept her will, appointing her husband as caretaker till her son comes of age. It's grotesque sort of dynastic politics. So this guy has now been indirectly elected president, because it's not a direct election. He would never win a direct election against someone else in the country. And one of the first things he's done is to say that the Chief Justice will not be taken back into the Supreme Court. The second thing, at his inauguration, the only other guy he invited there was Hamid Karzai, the puppet leader of Kabul, and they both hugged each other. I'm dying to get photographs of this out on posters, because it just says it all. And it's a message to the U.S., look, here I am, and I'm doing what you wanted. But he's an ideal politician. I mean, he came to power. The initial line of the State Department was that they didn't want Musharraf out as long as Bush was in the White House, because he said he's a close ally. If he is removed, it'll weaken the war on terror. Unknown to the State Department, Khalilzad and Cheney's, clearly with Cheney's say-so, was giving Zardari advice for 6 months prior to Musharraf's fall, evidently helping him to plan how to get rid of the general. And when the State Department found out, the emails that flew, which the New York Times made public, were quite astonishing. Richard Boucher, the Undersecretary of State in charge of Pakistan, writing to Khalilzad, could you tell us what your negotiations with Mr. Zardari, were these official? Were these personal? Could we have details of them? Clearly livid that this had been going on behind the scenes. Khalilzad is a sort of inveterate factionalist and operator. He hated Musharraf because Musharraf made no secret of the fact that Karzai was a total stooge and treated him as such. Didn't like him at all. They loathed each other. So Khalilzad has been after Musharraf for some time, and in Zardari he has a perfect creature, a total corrupt guy. With the U.S. has all the details of the corruption. If he turns nasty on them, they'll say, right, open up this case here, this case there, this case here.
Speaking of Tariq Ali, author most recently of The Duel, just out from Scribner's, what's his longevity?
Good question. I think the U.S., by deciding to go into Pakistan and bomb it, the tribal areas on the border with Afghanistan, killing innocent people. I mean, 3 weeks ago they killed 20 people, most of whom were women and children, according to the Pakistan government. If this carries on, well, they're going to make it very difficult, both for Zardari and the army. Zardari, of course, is dispensable. You know, he can be flushed down the toilet, that's not a problem for them, but it's creating big problems for the army, and the army is important for the United States because it's the only institution they really can rely on in that country. And when General Kayani, the head of the army, says we will not accept a breach of our sovereignty and we will resist, he means, of course, raids by Marines. When he was asked, what about the bombings from air, he said, well, how can we resist those, meaning we don't have the power to do that, and anyway, that would be a war. But within the army, there is a great deal of anger that they're being humiliated in this fashion. by a so-called ally. And I think that will be worrying the generals greatly. So if the situation gets out of control, which it might well, because once you start doing these things, then there's a response, either regular or irregular, and things get out of control. So Zardari, is how long he stays in power really depends very much on the United States and what happens in Afghanistan, and how long the army are prepared to let him run the country. I mean, if there's a crisis which gets serious, they'll just take over.
Is there much hope for a more humane order in Pakistan?
Well, you know, Doug, I always say that the people of Pakistan deserve better. Most of them are illiterate. Education is barely spread in the country, but their political instincts are far better than those of their rulers. The Pakistani ruling elite is one of the most corrupt and callous elites in the world, and that is saying a lot. Their human life is cheap. They don't care if people die. They don't care what is happening on the ground. There are levels of malnutrition, which are quite shocking. I point out to people, and I provide the statistics in this book, that at the same time as they're talking about Islamism and jihadism and this, that the real problems that confront Pakistan are social and economic. The latest UN figures show that 60% of children born in Pakistan are being born stunted because of malnutrition. 60%. Now, this to me is one of the most shocking figures to come out of that country. Has it had a big impact in the country as a whole or within the elite? No. My niece, who's a sort of leading journalist, she first alerted me to this some years ago, and I didn't quite take it in till I saw the statistics. She said she went to buy clothes for her kid, who was then 5. And she said, I went into the bazaar to buy ordinary clothes, not the special boutiques, because she likes the clothes which other kids wear on the streets. So she said she couldn't find, she said, no, it's for a 5-year-old. And then the shopkeeper looked at her, and seeing she was from a different class background, said, oh, well, I better give you clothes for 8-year-olds then, because the clothes we have for 5-year-olds are for very small kids. And she found that weird. She said, I think this is to do with kids being born stunted, but I didn't believe it till I saw these UN figures. It's quite horrific.
Well, India has had certainly has lots of poverty, but it's also had an economic boom, at least in portions of the country, for portions of the people. Nothing like that in Pakistan.
No. The Indian ruling elite, especially in the first 15 years after independence, led by a progressive, modernizing Congress government, did two things. One, they instituted very radical land reforms, which broke the power of the landlords over the countryside, reduced all that. You had a, you know, sort of green revolution, they called it, in the countryside, which was an exaggeration, but nonetheless the countryside benefited. And the second thing they did push through was education. Now, India produced even in the late 70s and 80s of the last century, had the largest number of unemployed graduates in the world, and they were doing other jobs, but it had that base. And so when the time was right, this base and this educational base could be used. And it has been used. I mean, China, if you look at another country, of course, also had a much larger social base than India, because they had a very highly skilled layer of people after the revolution who were physicists, chemists, you know, trained to run things, educated to a high level, mathematicians. And so when capitalism finally hit China, this layer came into its own. They had it there. India had it to a lesser extent. Pakistan does not have it. The bulk, I think it's probably an exaggeration to say a bulk, but certainly a majority of Pakistani doctors are working in the United States. These are people who could be working at home if there was a health service, or if there were hospitals. There are some state-of-the-art hospitals in Pakistan, but only for the rich. Ordinary people couldn't even afford them.
Speaking of Tariq Ali, author of The Duel, just out from Scribner's, I just finished reading a book, The Weary Titan, about the decline of the British Empire, and struck by the fact that turning its attention from a very embarrassing and difficult imperial war in southern Africa, Britain then turned its attentions to Afghanistan. And it seems to me there's some parallels with the U.S. is doing right now. Of course, we have our Democratic candidate for president wants to redouble our commitment to that country. What is the situation in Afghanistan before we talk about Obama in that country?
The situation in Afghanistan is dire. The regime imposed by the NATO powers on the country has turned out to be a total disaster. And for why? Before that, let me just say this, that when the Taliban was overthrown, to be totally honest with you, very few tears were shed in Afghanistan or in neighboring Pakistan, because everyone knew what this regime had become and its repression. And there was a feeling that people didn't want the West to occupy Afghanistan, but on the other hand, the Taliban had been toppled, so maybe, perhaps, some people felt something good might come out of it. Nothing came out of it. They imposed a regime, and I argued at the time that this is not going to be a Marshall Plan type situation, which the more utopian elements in Pakistan were hoping for, and that this is imperialism in the time of neoliberalism, and they will do, how can they do in Afghanistan what they don't do in their own countries? It's very unlikely that they're going to transform Afghanistan into a social democratic paradise. And of course that didn't happen. But what shocked Afghans was that Karzai and the group of people around him just looted the country and looted the aid that was coming in. I mean, NATO troops stood by and protected these guys, becoming fat cats, stealing prime land in Kabul, constructing giant villas, people who didn't have a penny to their name before, but because they were with Karzai. So the corruption became a problem within 8 months of Karzai being imposed. And there's a famous incident, which I report in the book, when there was a meeting between Musharraf and Karzai some years ago. A senior Pakistani official told me that Karzai was going on to Musharraf about, you don't control the border, smuggling goes on, and Musharraf lost his cool, and said, well, you should know a lot about smuggling, because your brother is the biggest arms and drug smuggler in the country. Why don't you bring him under control before you give us lectures? And Karzai's face went pale. And you talk to any U.S. official and they will confirm that with you. There was recently a report published in the New York Times by a former U.S. ambassador who was in charge of investigating the heroin business. And it's a devastating report. It just backs up everything some of us have been saying for ages. It's a corrupt regime. Under the dreaded Taliban, two things had been stopped. Rape, because their punishments for rape were completely scary. I mean, sometimes they castrated the rapists, sometimes they executed them. Rape did go down, there's no doubt about it, whether we like it or not. And they had stopped heroin production. The poppies fields were being slowly brought under control. They were finding other ways of money. So they were crazies in some ways, but not so dumb in other ways, especially in terms of controlling the poppies. Once this new regime came in, poppy fields grew. The amount of heroin being smuggled into the West and Iran is just completely now out of control. And the social situation in the country is appalling. That's the regime. Then you have NATO. I mean, if you read Elizabeth Rubin's reports in the New York Times, reporting from the battlefields in the Badlands in Afghanistan, she may not even know it, but they really reminded me of Halberstam's reports from Vietnam in the same paper in the 60s and 70s. Just the way she describes what's going on, and sometimes you feel she doesn't even know what she's saying, but she does describe it, it's obvious that the foreigners are hated. And why anyone is surprised by this, Afghanistan hated the Brits when they went in the 19th century and basically gave them a bloody nose. They did the same to the Russians with the help of Brzezinski in the United States, and they're now doing that to the United States. So they're not going to tolerate that. And the logic of this war is exactly the same. They go and kill civilians. The families they kill want revenge, because the culture of revenge is very strong in that part of the world, and go and join the neo-Taliban, saying, fine. They killed my mother, they killed my daughter, they killed her, they bombed a wedding party. So the number of civilian deaths in Afghanistan is so high that even Karzai, the puppet ruler, publicly said the civilian casualties are unacceptable and NATO should do something about it. This is the guy supposedly running the country, had to say that. And this has created a situation where no one now, very few people apart from the NGOs and a handful of people, want NATO to stay there. And they're not going to be able to stay there. So you ask these guys, what are your strategic aims in Afghanistan? No one takes seriously it's to destroy Al-Qaeda, because, you know, bin Laden, whether he's dead or alive, no one knows. But that you can't occupy a country for, you know, now nearly 9 years to keep that going. So what are your war aims? I mean, what are you there for? Recently, the Secretary General of NATO, speaking to the Brookings Institution in Washington, said, when asked by a sympathetic audience, what are our aims in Afghanistan, said, don't you see that Afghanistan is on the borders with China and Iran? And how can we lose this country? It's a strategic asset. Just like that.
It's like the British looking to Afghanistan as the buffer against the Russians in India, right?
Yeah.
Well, now we have the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama, saying we need to redouble our efforts. That the problem from the beginning, we didn't do enough. The forces were too small to the task. And he's going to fix that by pulling some people out of Iraq. What do you make of this?
It is so crazy and counterproductive, Doug, that one does wonder whether Brzezinski and Samantha Power and his other advisors really know what's going on in that country. Brzezinski certainly should know about it, because he was involved heavily in backing the jihad against the Soviet Union. So he should know what the dangers of increasing U.S. troops in Afghanistan are. For Obama himself, this is a guy who is intelligent and should read books, and I would recommend that he reads my book, because I think it'll be helpful to him to try and understand what is going on in that.
He's probably rather busy now.
Never too busy to read a book. But he is a politician who writes books, so I assume who reads them, and he writes his own books. He doesn't have them ghosted. But I think, essentially, it's a big, big mistake the Democrats are making by pushing everything to a consensual center, which has been a problem with American politics for a long time. And what made Obama popular at the initial stages with the young people especially was they thought he was different. He's now said that the surge in Iraq has been very successful and that more troops have to be sent to Afghanistan. I mean, it is a problem. You know, I mean, one can't have any illusions. If you're running an empire, you can't have an imperial president who doesn't defend it. But the question is he defending the best interests of this country by sending in more troops to Afghanistan? Or, in fact, is it going to result in another debacle? I don't think they've thought it through at all. And Obama was the first politician in the United States before Hillary. In fact, Hillary told him off for that, and even McCain, to say that we should cross the Pakistan border, regardless of Pakistani sovereignty, and do what has to be done. So, you know, pretending to be a dove in Iraq, or possibly being a dove in Iraq and becoming a hawk in Afghanistan, may be a balance to strike from his point of view in the run-up to November. But in terms of the needs of the people of Afghanistan or Pakistan, it's just completely crazy and will be seen as such. And it might, you know, it won't, because he can, whenever a Democrat does war talk, you can never, once you enter that terrain, you can always be outflanked by the Republicans. I mean, this has historically been the case. You go into the terrain of the enemy to fight, and the enemy always has an advantage.
And speaking of which, you're a frequent visitor here, you follow American politics. What do you make of our presidential campaign?
I was in New York when Obama made his first big speech defending the pastor. Not the second one, after the pastor decided to launch his own book and went out of control. But the first speech Obama made, I actually saw it live on CNN. And I was quite amazed and said that this is a politician with a difference, because I couldn't think of any British politician making a speech like that, leave alone an American one. There are few enough European politicians these days who could deliver a speech. And it was a serious speech trying to explain, not treating the American people as stupid and foolish, and trying to explain to them what racism has done to this country and what it is and why the pastor said what he did. Well, okay, that was the past. But subsequently, the closer Obama has got to the presidency, the more he's begun to shift, and you know, now seems, when you watch him, still intelligent, but there's a lot of empty rhetoric. The speech he gave in Berlin when he went was essentially an empty speech, lacked substance. He had very little to say there, and I think he's not playing to his strengths. His strengths are to say what he feels and to be upfront. That is what got him the support. At the moment, the sort of dead hand of the Democratic Party leadership has just got him. I mean, they impose, presumably, Joe Biden on him. Now, Doug, I don't live in this country, but even I know from afar that Joe Biden is a dud. The guy's a sort of, you know, busted flush. He's not someone you need as your vice presidential candidate to reassure the great American public. And the fact that this is the case, and, you know, the nation, I was shocked to see, was backing Biden, and all their writers saying, yeah, Biden for vice president. For what? You know, they think in such crazy conformist terms of balancing the ticket. It would have been far better if he'd found, you know, someone a bit more abrasive, sharp, original, new to be his vice presidential candidate. He didn't. So he's now stuck with Biden, who I heard saying yesterday on U.S. television, I think Barack might have made a mistake in not having Hillary as the vice presidential candidate. This is, I'm sure, inspires a great deal of confidence in people watching, saying that this guy is unsure that he should be where he is. On the other side, you had a clever Republican campaign. I thought that there was no way McCain could win, and I'm still pretty sure that the Republicans are going to lose, but you can never tell in the United States. But then Karl Rove and the Republican leadership, seeing in Obama a celebrity figure, decided to construct a celebrity of their own. Very cynically, but very cleverly, and found in the governor of Alaska a person who fitted the bill. Someone totally crude, very religious, with problems of her own. I did wonder when the story about her 17-year-old child being pregnant. I did think, actually, just imagine if Obama's daughters had been older, one of them had been 17 and had been pregnant. Just imagine what the coverage of the national media would have been had that been the case. So the contrast in how they're treating her with kid gloves and how the other side would have been treated is interesting. But the fact is that from the point of view of the Republicans, unpleasant though this grotesque from Alaska is, she seems to fit the bill, because the Republican Party seems to have changed completely, you know, since from what it used to be. Mainstream Republicanism seems to have disappeared, and the nutty faction is in power, and Sarah Palin is the one capable of revitalizing the nutty faction, who were feeling very depressed that they'd been lumbered with this old guy who they didn't know was going to survive the election campaign or not.
Wasn't reliably nutty either.
And he wasn't reliably nutty, especially on social issues. So now they've got a total sort of candidate on their side, and, you know, the Rush Limbaugh is claiming he was the first to mention her as the choice, and he's glad that his advice has been accepted, and the extreme right within the Republican Party on its fringes is going crazy. And they've got a celebrity who's pushed Obama out of the headlines. They've made her that. So it's a very clever, astute operation by the Republicans, which took the Democrats by surprise. Had Obama, who knows what would have happened if Obama had found a better running mate. But I think once they saw Biden, they just must have chuckled and rubbed their hands and said, right, we're going to outflank this one. And they've done it. Now, the question is this. Given that there's a big recession in this country, you have the collapse of the fourth largest bank, you have a Bush government effectively nationalizing two large mortgage companies, all the nostrums of neoliberalism are collapsing before our very eyes, you would have thought that a Democratic candidate would have gone further, more in a New Deal direction of Roosevelt, and said this is a big crisis, even the Republicans who want to make the rich richer are being forced to do this, and come up with a proper economic plan. No, they haven't done this. So far, and it's unlikely that they will because it's risky, or they see it as risky. Secondly, on foreign policy, calling for a total break on Iraq and Afghanistan and saying we've got ourselves involved in these wars, we have to pull back and we have to think of how to reformulate U.S. foreign policy. This is not in our interests. Haven't done that either. So I think they're sort of caught in a trap. Now, whether the American public will punish Bush and the Republicans for the economic crisis and the wars, you know, in most other parts of the world they would have been punished, but this is the United States, and so you can never predict what is going to happen there. But I think unless the Democrats really go on an aggressive political campaigning mode and come up with real alternatives, they might lose themselves this election. I don't think that the Republicans can win it. I think the Democrats could lose it.
And finally, with Bush leaving office as you say, financial crisis and the recession dominating the economic news and imperial defeat dominating the foreign policy news, is the sun setting on the American empire?
Well, I think it's too early to say that. Lots of us felt that when they suffered a massive defeat in Vietnam in April 1975, we thought the American empire, or some of us did, I was sort of partially of that opinion, would not be able to recover, but they do recover. But what we are now seeing is an interesting development, that in the Cold War days, the expansion of capitalism was exactly the same as the expansion of U.S. hegemony. When capitalism expanded anywhere, you felt this was a big strengthening of U.S. hegemony. With the end of communism and the conquest by capital of the whole world, the expansion of capitalism doesn't necessarily mean the expansion of U.S. hegemony. That is what we are seeing now. The Chinese, of course, are the big imponderables in the current world. But behind the scenes, they are active. One shouldn't have any doubts about that. The Russians have now come out to play the regional hegemon and expose the total hypocrisy of the Western powers by saying, we can behave like you behave. You did that in Kosovo, we're doing that in the region. And it's impossible to reply to them. So if you say there are no international norms, and where the West, the United States, determines these international norms, you now have a power saying, fine, you play that game, we can play it too. So I think the events in Georgia, the continued problems in Iraq, the trouble in Afghanistan are showing this empire to be overstretched. Let's put it like that. It's an overstretched empire with a mega economic crisis on its hands. In other times, this would be a recipe for some radical movements to arise within the United States itself. We haven't seen that happening, but I think the American empire is certainly weaker now, ideologically, if not militarily. The idea of the United States as the good guy in the world, that has suffered very heavy blows. And you cannot maintain an imperial presence simply in this day, simply on the basis of military superiority. You just can't do it, which is why, you know, in the old days it was we're fighting for freedom and democracy. More recently, humanitarian interventions, i.e. we're fighting for humanity. But you kill 1 million people in Iraq and you're killing, you know, tens of thousands in Afghanistan, and you can't quite say that you're fighting on behalf of humanity. So the mask, the imperial mask, has fallen off. That's become very clear. And neither Samantha Power nor all these other ideologues around Obama will find it easy to put that mask back on again, though they will probably have a try. I think the empire has been weakened, and some of the more astute commentators recognize this and want change, but the change can only come at their mass movements below.